Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Syrett, SYRETT. And the website is strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, demons, supernatural beings typically associated with evil, prevalent historically in religion, occultism, literature, fiction, mythology, folklore, comic books, video games, countless movies and television series. But what are they? Where do they come from? What do they want? Are demonic possessions real? The Bible tells us that demons are fallen angels who joined Satan in his rebellion against God and who were defeated and cast out of heaven along with Satan. We'll find out what demonologist Nathaniel Gillis has discovered when Coast to Coast AM continues. Nathaniel J. Gillis is an author, lecturer, and religious demonologist. After being in the deliverance ministry for 15 years, Nathaniel felt called to bring his gifts and research to a more secular venue. The experience he's had as a child while living in a haunted house inspired him to research the fields of demonology and the paranormal. In addition to such disciplines, Nathaniel is also the founder of Preternatural Epiphenomenal Philosophy. It's his belief that demonology is not the study of new life, but the study of old life in a new way. Hey, Nathaniel, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Doing good, sir. It's an honor to be with everyone, and hello, Coast to Coast.
Let's just dive right in and tell me about growing up in a haunted house. Where was the house?
It was in Dayton, Ohio. It was in the east side of Dayton, Ohio, and it wasn't an old house or anything like that, but I remember being 8 and 9 years old, and my parents taking me to the open house before they had purchased it and led me by the hand into what was going to be my room. And I remember this stench, this rancid smell of what it was, really decomposition. And I also looked underneath the bed, and I saw a little girl. She may have been about 6 or 7. And it was a full-bodied apparition, my very first time being in the house. And that was the first event that opened up the entire can of worms.
So you were secretly hoping, I'm guessing, that they didn't close on the house?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I was hoping that something would come up. But sure enough, they closed on the house. And I ended up moving into that room, and then for the next 6 to 8 years or so, it was just, shadow people, apparitions, shadow people, apparitions. A dark, ominous cloud would just hover in the corner of the room at night. I would always hear something physical, something material that would displace the weight on the wooden floors, and it was just like somebody was walking all the way up to my bedroom door at night, and it would just stop. And so that was my introduction into the field of the paranormal, whether or not I wanted it to be so.
And did you ever see that little girl, that full-on apparition under the bed again?
No, sir, I didn't. Shockingly enough, I didn't. I wish that I would have, because the other entities that I did encounter were much more malevolent and haunting. Like I said, the shadow person that I saw was actually staring at me through the window. He was standing outside, and I couldn't see, it wasn't the Hat Man or anything. I didn't see red eyes or anything of the like. I just saw this thin black figure, shadow person. And then the next day, I remember vividly, it was wintertime. So I got up for school the next morning, and I looked outside, and there were 2 footprints in the snow. Now, here's the problem, though. The windowsill was about 7 foot tall. So whatever this entity was, it had to have been a very large, large being.
And was this relentless? Was this day in or day out? Was it sporadic? What was the frequency?
It's a good question. I would say this, that it started out sporadically. You know, that periodically you would have a manifestation, but it became almost an attachment to me. And I don't want to say that in terms of I was possessed or anything remotely close to that, but I would go and visit friends and have sleepovers at their houses, and it would follow me. I remember one night, it was a Sunday night, and I'm sitting there sleeping in my friend's room while he, you know, we were kids, so he's sleeping in his parents' bed with them, and I could hear his stairs creaking, like someone was walking up the stairs, and there was just such a paralyzing fear that would grip my heart, and, it really helped me develop an immunity, just being able to withstand some of these attacks that I would encounter later on in my calling. But yeah, it was a wild event in my life.
And how long did you live in that house?
I think it was about 8 years, close to 8 years. And I visited them again. Like, I visited the house earlier about 2 years ago. And I didn't get to meet the people inside the house, but I'm still friends with the neighbors around it. And they said that since we moved out, that the house has not had people within it, like tenants or even homeowners, for longer than 7 months at a time. And so, you know, anybody that's in the field, they know that if a house is haunted, it's very difficult to keep tenants inside. They just want to get out, which is natural, I suppose.
8 years of this, mm-hmm. You must have, it must have done some serious damage to your mental health at that time.
Yes, sir. It was a struggle. It was a struggle. I think I failed one or two grades. And the problem that I had was much like, even after the apparition, even after shadow figure, all of that was profound and meaningful and impactful on me, but nothing was as moving and terrifying as the nightmares that accompanied it. I mean, I would have the same nightmare over and over and over again, and I was walking in the dream, in the nightmare, I was walking towards a picnic table in a reserve at a park where people have family reunions, and I saw two boys. Both of them had their backs turned towards me. One on the right was shooting heroin or something into his left arm, which, you know, I was a kid, so I had no frame of reference for that. But later on in life, I realized what he was doing. And the kid on the left, I guess he had noticed me, and so he turns around, smiles, sticks a revolver in his mouth, and would pull the trigger. And that was always, always the nightmare. It would never change. And then I would wake up in the middle of the night with a cold sweat. The room would feel sick. It was heavy with this presence. And I've never heard anybody else describe it this way. And hopefully there are some other people out there who've experienced this kind of malevolent presence. But when it entered my room at night, it made me feel like it was meaningless. Like it made me feel like I was the smallest particle in existence compared to it. And so that really did, I don't want to say it afflicted my mind. But later on in life, I really begin to understand or seek to understand what it was. And I really do believe that a lot of this manifestation and this phenomenon, a lot of it is it's a language in a sense. And I think that a lot of times we will interpret ourselves and misinterpret the actual entity. And that's what has led me into hopefully redefining some of these manifestations, especially in the context of demonology.
Fascinating, a language. I want to come back to that, but a couple of more points on the on your youth growing up in this haunted house. Mm-hmm. Surely your parents must have taken notice of what was happening. Why didn't they move?
I don't know. I mean, I do know that my dad was working first shift. My mother was working at a daycare, and I don't know. I really can't answer that question. I know this. That it took them a while to realize that there was something real going on, you know, and it wasn't just the overactive imagination of a child, you know. But I could say this about it. It left me with an impenetrable desire to understand this and to help save people and at least help them understand what they're experiencing in ways that I didn't as a child. I mean, when you're 8 and 9 years old and there's no one to talk to and all you can do is shake and cry, at some point, you like, again, you build a defense against it. And at some point, you are almost forced to reconsider what it is, just so you'll feel safer in its presence. But it came up to a head. It came to an end one night where I just, you know, what happened was I was staying up all night. And for some reason, I always felt safer. I had the lights on, but I would always sleep better when the sun rose in the morning. And so I would have to stay up all night till about 6:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I would get about an hour and a half of sleep before I go to school. And then I would just crash at school. And it was, you know, it was a pattern, systematic pattern of existence that had to come to an end. And it did one night when I just walked into my bathroom and shut the door, crawled up in a ball in the corner of the room, and I just began to pray. And I cried. And I said, God, I don't know what this is. I don't know what it wants with me. I don't know why you're allowing this to happen to me. I said, but I'm tired. I don't know what else to do. And I felt something, a second presence, enter that room. And it left such an impression on me. And I immediately felt that presence, the entity, the evil entity, just dissipate. And the weight had lifted. I felt lighter. It was just a magnificent moment. And thankfully that happened, and thankfully I can use those scars as weapons now to help push these beasts back into the darkness.
So you come from a Christian background. Is that how, through that faith filter, is that how you began to understand what these entities were initially, from kind of a biblical perspective?
Yes, yes and no. I grew up in a Pentecostal tradition, and so we did have exorcists. They weren't throwing holy water or anything like that. They have their own traditions in it. But, you know, the main theology there, their tradition was that demons are either the offspring of fallen angels, or they are fallen angels in and within themselves. So it was biblically rooted, but I soon began to reinterpret these texts through the lens of Hebrew tradition and not just through Western scholarship. And I think that the truth is far more chilling than we could have fathomed here in the Western church. And my position right now, I'm not a systematic demonologist. Systematic demonology is the discipline where someone says, okay, that you know, demonology is dominated by an hierarchy. I don't believe that. It's not Beelzebub and Belial. I am of the tradition where I believe that these are evil disincarnate entities that Yahweh fought with over and over again from Genesis 6 to Ezekiel 13. And it's exactly what's going to happen in the future, and I'm excited to hopefully get into that tonight.
Yes, yes. And also, perhaps we could a little bit later compare demonology with the other Abrahamic religions. You mentioned Judaism, and we're talking about Christianity and so forth. So when you talk about the paranormal and you talk about these discarnate entities, you know, people talk about ghosts, and they talk about unclean spirits, and they talk about shadow people. Are they different classifications, or are they all sort of one and the same?
It's a good question. And I know I have friends that are in the field, and they may differ, and that's okay. I understand. You know, I love and respect them, and I'll never, you know, disrespect their beliefs at all. But I can say this, that the shadow people in my mind, they are in the process of devolving. It's right out of Genesis 1 and 1. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. It's a shadow person. They're the most evil entities out there. And so, you know, all of these terms, these manifestations that we are witnessing all across the world for millennia, they were not foreign to Hebrew consciousness. They were very much present. Matter of fact, these shadow people were called shades in biblical antiquity. And that's where we get the word shadow. They believe the shades were the deceased, the spirits of the deceased people. And so these different manifestations that even I encountered, they're written in the Bible. They're spoken about in the Bible. Even ufology and UFO abduction is spoken in the Bible. Even before that, back to ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia, But I do believe that the entities that we are witnessing are all in a certain way. They're all in their own stages of the afterlife. So, you know, we have the possessing entities. We have one entity who most likely, this is according to Jaime Vital and Isaac Luria, the great Kabbalistic exorcists of the 16th century, the two kinds of possessing entity. One wants to have a body again. The other, those are the malevolent entities. The others are people who've lived and died, and they died outside of their time. They have been murdered. They may have committed suicide, or they may have suffered a traumatic tragedy. And for whatever reason, they're restless, and so they attach themselves to people. So I do believe that all of these entities, and I can prove it at least biblically, that they all fall under the linguistic umbrella of a ghost.
And do all ghosts have consciousness? Because sometimes we hear about apparitions, you know, coming down the same staircase at the same hour on the same day, almost like it's in an endless loop. So do you make a differentiation between entities with consciousness as opposed to, I don't know, what you would call those echoes from the past, I guess?
That's a good theory. I know that doing, you know, what are some of these haunted excavations and treating it as if it's an excavation, you will kickstart an apparition who seems to be doing the same thing. But even with Pliny the Elder, he had an apparition visit him, which was an old man in chains, and it kept doing it over and over and over again until he realized that this entity was telling him a story. Turns out, you know, he went outside the courtyard, dug his grave up, found the body, the bones, with chains on them. And again, that goes back to my theory that even if these entities are just, it's almost as if they're in a stage, a process of grieving, even if they're just doing one act over and over again, it's almost a language to them. It's a form of communication, and many times we will misunderstand it. And I think that the further demonology moves into new growths and new revolutionary thoughts, we will start to see it as such, and we'll learn another form of communication outside of EVP.
What are they trying to tell us?
Most of them, it's their story. Most of them, it's their story. Like with Pliny the Elder, the man had chains, wanted a proper burial, give me a proper burial. And I think that speaks to, again, these manifestations of the afterlife. These entities are operating in many cases on a different belief system than we are, majorly. And if we can understand what they value in terms of demons, it'll be revolutionary to the field, because I don't believe that a demon is what its name is. I believe a demon is what it values. And if we can weaponize that understanding, then our idea and concept of possession, exorcism, the afterlife, it will all fall into place, and we'll get a better understanding of what's really going on here.
We just have a 2 minutes here before the break at the bottom of the hour, but let's start the conversation now. So then, if demons are not these, you know, horned, cloven-hooved disciples of Beelzebub, what are they?
Okay. The demon was a migratory loan word that obviously it came from the Greek. But we're dealing essentially with two different entities. One entity, again, is an evil disincarnate spirit who operates with the belief system and mindset that's reminiscent of a serial killer. He has the second
entity. I'm just going to jump in right here, Nathaniel. We'll take a quick time out. We'll come back and pick up on that thread. Scientists from Texas have identified the tiny fossil of a millipede that lived more than 425 million years ago. The remarkable discovery, which was made on the island of Carrera in the Scottish Inner Hebrides, is older than any other known insect or arachnid, and dates back to the mid-Paleozoic era. That's my favorite era, the mid-Paleozoic era. To find it, researchers from the University of Texas, Austin, extracted microscopic minerals from the rock before using a low-tech method, gluing a pin to the tip of a pencil to locate any fossils. The millipede is about 75 million years older than the previous oldest known insect. Back to more of my conversation with Nathaniel Gillis as we talk demons on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from my little studio beneath the stairs in Thornhill, Ontario, just north of Toronto. And you can say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Nathaniel Gillis, demonologist, stays with us. We were talking about what demons actually are. So of the major religions, which one is closest to having it right in your estimation?
Well, I think they all have their own descriptions. I think they're describing the same thing. So I would say in unison, they're all equally as right. If we can kind of lump them in and say, okay, what are all of their descriptions pointing to? So, for instance, you have your jinn, which can procreate. How can demons procreate? You have the shindalid and the dybbuk in Judaism, which can also desires to have, you know, relations and intimacy. So, you know, in the demon, again, demon and Christianity, all of these entities are the same things. They're just described in different ways because of, you know, the different Abrahamic religions. But you had asked a question earlier about what these entities are after. They're after a social skin. They're after their epidermal essence that they no longer have. And I think that the idea of possession is a test run to what they did and what they're going to do again in Genesis 6, which was essentially create children that had the likeness of their apparitions, so that they could actually possess the body again and have the actual physical, materialized manifestation of what their apparition truly looks like. Does it make sense?
In a very disturbing manner, yes, unfortunately. Okay. So are you saying that that they want to procreate with us?
Yes. What happened in Genesis 6 is fascinating. That is, at least in the Christian tradition, that is the very first clue that we are given about what it is their intentions are. Now, I know that a lot of people will go to the Book of Enoch, and I believe in the Book of Enoch. I don't discount it at all. But we have the Testament of Reuben, we have the Book of Enoch, the Book of Watchers, all of these different authors and different books that are all pointing to the same event. But in academia, they have all these books. They have what are called in academia meaning-bearing inconsistencies. So one book will blame it on the women and say, well, the women were too sensual and they drew the attention of the watchers. Then the other person will come in there and chime in and say, no, it wasn't the women. It was the watchers' fault. And then the third person will say, you guys are both wrong. It's the sons of Seth. Again, they're all describing the same event. They're just doing it a different way. So if you strip them of the opinions and get down to the nitty-gritty, you'll find exactly what is written in what's called the Apocryphon of John. It's the Apocalypse of John. It's a part of the Gnostic manuscripts. I know a lot of people will frown on it, but listen to what I'm about to say. This is absolutely vital. In that passage, in that text, the author describes how it was that these entities took unto them wives. It said that at first they appeared to the wives as though they were their husbands. So they took the shape of their beloved. And then when in the actual act of intimacy, at the moment of impregnation, they would stare into the faces of their victims and instantaneously change into their original apparition. And they says, quote, and from the darkness they begat children whose likeness, their skin, their physical manifestation was the same likeness as the entity that changed into its original form. In other words, what they did, an old Mesopotamian ritual. They believed that whatever the woman was fixated upon at that moment, she will create that image in her womb. And that's how they got consent, and that's how they created. It wasn't children in the terms of what we're used to hearing. No, these were what are called social skins, the second self that they literally stepped into, possessed, so that they could actually feel, love, touch, and experience life again. So again, I'll tell everybody out there, possession is a test run. This is the ultimate goal. This is where the battle is waged right now. It's never been about horns and hoofs. It's always been about, Yahweh says in Ezekiel 13, he says, he calls them soul hunters, Richard. He calls them, he says, you kill the innocent to keep the guilty alive. It's necromancy. That's why in the Apocalypse of John, it says from the darkness. Why? It's a reference to the dead. They sit in darkness. It's right out of Psalms. So that's
why are they called watchers, Nathaniel? Why are they called watchers?
That goes all the way back down to the Apkallu in ancient Mesopotamia. It's what's in academia, one of the tools that we have in interpreting scriptures, we have to go to what's called comparative etymology. And so the term watchers, gardeners, and guardians were titles and descriptions that were given to both the Apkallu and these watchers that are found in Daniel and in Genesis 6. But I would like everyone to hear me, and let me point this out to you guys. That Genesis 6 narrative is the canvas upon which Yahweh places a story about the role these watchers played. These watchers, they were in charge of guarding the dead. That's what they were called, watchers. As a matter of fact, in Orthodox Judaism right now, it's called Shomer Nagia, where they would actually guard the deceased. And so I would encourage everyone, if you're going to look through Genesis 6 through the lens of the Hebrew text, then we have to understand what role these watchers were playing. Matter of fact, if you go into the New Testament, when Mary Magdalene goes to see the body of Jesus, she sees two angels in the tomb, doesn't think that they're watchers. Again, I don't believe they're fallen angels at all. But she looks at two angels, and then turns and sees Jesus, and she mentions, she says, I thought you were the gardener. Again, it's a reference back to the watchers and their role. And so Genesis 6 is absolutely about necromancy. That's how, it's what it's always been about, where they will take the life of the innocent, put the spirit of the guilty in the body to possess it. In Yahweh, the whole plan of salvation was to reverse this curse. And I really, I mean, it's going to be a groundbreaking revelation. I hope it is.
Well, how can a discarnate spirit have relations with a physical being? How is it possible?
It does, and it should be. What we have here is an age-old question. One of the first demonologists to ask it was, Father Sinistrari of Amino, he was a Franciscan priest, and he wrote a book on the incubus and succubus entities. And if you notice the victimology of the Apocalypse of John and how these entities would manifest to these women, you'll see that victimology and psychopathology all throughout the incubus legends and the Divic lore. And what they would do, and this is the only thing that Father Sinistrari and even Montague Summers could come up with, that was that they were going to the carcass, this is okay, quote unquote, they would go to the carcasses of the deceased in graveyards, possess the body to get biological substances, and then take that and transplant it into a living person through a dream and pregnancy. So you would have the incubus who would do it to a woman, then you had the succubus who would go and find substance from a man, and they would go back to and fro. Now, why is that important? It's important because possession begins far before the slithering, hissing voices and disembodied, chants. It starts way beyond that, and it ends even after death. And again, that's the question. How are they doing it? Why are they doing it? Where are they getting it from? They're appearing to people as if they're related. Again, they appear to the women as if they were their husbands. It's not their husbands. And so the quicker we can understand what it is they're after, the more we'll be able to really just get a better grasp on it and start to fight against it.
So after possession, then, that's the test run, you say. After possession, they will try and procreate with us.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Matter of fact, this again, this is why I really have a, I don't really have a bone to pick with systematic demonology. I just think that it, until we're going to ask the right questions, we're going to keep getting the wrong answers. And here's the issue. Demons are not what they do. They are what they believe in. What they do, again, a lot of them are interested in intimacy. Now, at first blush, when I started to research the D-Boot phenomenon, I was under the understanding that these entities were just possessing entities. But that's not true. It began with them grooming their victims, specifically women. They, you know, and there's so many stories throughout. I would recommend everybody to go out and read a lot of Isaac Luria's work and Jaime Vital's work, because they would groom their victims and after an act of intimacy, possess them. So much so that there was a rabbi, his name was Rabbi Zacuto, and he was performing an exorcism on a woman who had had intercourse with an apparition. And that apparition had crawled up, according to this rabbi, exorcist, it crawled up in her womb like a baby, causing them, these exorcists, to really debate, is, are they possessed with these entities or are they pregnant with them? God, that's chilling. And as, if we can understand that, then the UFO abduction phenomenon is going to fall right in our lap, and we will see it for what it is. These beings, again, it's right up Apocalypse of John. He said they were creating copies of bodies. And in my research, I can prove that what they're doing to stay alive, this goes all the way back to Mesopotamia and Ezekiel 13. They had a belief that if you killed the body and the spirit wasn't in it, then the spirit that possessed it stays alive. And so these entities will bounce to and fro from body to body to body because they do not want to die. And Yahweh leveled a curse against them in Ezekiel 13. It's just, it's a fascinating subject.
Are they all malevolent, or are they, some of them, simply, I don't know, misguided?
These particular entities that I'm describing right now have the modus operandi of serial killers. There are other entities who are, for whatever reason, displaced or still attached to someone or something in this dimension. But these entities that I'm describing right now have a whole different belief system than we do. Matter of fact, in Ezekiel 13, he says that they slip into the houses of their victims. They snatch, this is fascinating, while they're asleep, they will give them a dream and then snatch, and Yahweh says that you hunt the souls of men to make them fly. It's a direct reference to an ancient Egyptian understanding of the soul, and that was that it was, it's called the Ba'ah, that when the man dies, that his soul leaves his body like a bird. And Yahweh says that you're killing the innocent to keep the guilty alive. Matter of fact, he says so that those who should die do not, and those who should live die. So again, guys, he called them dream diviners, not in the sense that he's a Joseph, but what is happening is, and this is awesome, he said in Ezekiel 13, he said that it's not just that you're divining a dream, and that's how you're killing these victims. He said, first you're giving them the dream, and then you're telling them what the dream meant. That's classic UFO abduction. It's not, it's missing time. It's screen memories. It's not, you know, and it's such a fascinating thing to understand. But it's right out of Mesopotamia. That's what they're doing. They're creating bodies for themselves. So it's very possible these entities and UFOs are not them at all. They're avatars. They're what's called Fritz Kramer in his book, The Red Fez, he called possession the social skin that these entities are using. They'll look human, they'll look alive, but they're just not like us.
Does it work the other way too, that female demons will try and procreate with a human male?
Yes,
or a living male?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. 100%. And in Mesopotamia, they called these beings Kudustu and Hudutsu. Now, and this is fascinating, guys. This will give us some context to what happened in Genesis 6. What we have in the Mesopotamian text, it's okay. So it's all about birthing children. That's what it's always been about to these guys, okay? It's always been about procreation. It's never been about the pleasure of intimacy. It's always been about begetting something that looks like it so we can possess it. So in Mesopotamia, we have the exorcist and we have the midwife who are, they're both present in the room when the woman is giving birth. Now, the exorcist's job was to keep the spirits away from the baby. The midwife's job was to keep the mother healthy enough and the baby healthy enough to come out of the womb. Now, what has happened since then, it's the watcher thing. These beings played a role between God and man. Some people, some scholars would say the priests and kings. But somewhere down the line, these beings, and they were mortals, they reversed their roles. So instead of the midwife, and what's fascinating too is they could be either male or female here. And that's also mentioned in Ezekiel 13. It's not just false prophets. It's also false prophetesses. But there was a reversal of roles, Richard. What happened was you have a midwife who puts the baby in. She's supposed to take the baby out. You have the exorcist who's supposed to take the spirit out. Instead, he puts another spirit in its place. And Yahweh called them soul hunters.
All right. Listen, Nathaniel, I need you to just hold on. Stay where you are. We'll come back on the other side, open up the phone lines, take questions and comments, and delve further into demonology.